Let's help the folks that are listening. And by the way, if you'd like to join the show, the toll-free number is 1-877-572-1895. And we're talking to Mr. David Simpson from the Fiscal Fitness Company. So let's start out at the top of the list. What represents a good financial plan for, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America? I mean, you know, for somebody that's listening to us tonight, David, what's a good financial plan as a baseline for them?
Well, you talk about those things that you kind of know intuitively. You know, the financial services industry has sold us on this word diversification. And intuitively, we all respond to it because we know that sounds right. You know, that sounds like a good idea. And there's only one problem, and I think it's a problem we incur all the time. There's always a good type and a bad type, or the right one and the wrong one, you know. And in this case, it's true, too. There's a true diversification and a false diversification. And so I would say the first good financial plan is to truly diversify. And what that means is you don't go to the broker and say, I want some large cap stocks and small cap stocks and real estate stocks and some bonds and some internationals. That's what they call diversification, and it's false because it's all in market assets. True diversification is having your money, maybe some in the market, that's okay, but you also want some in cash. And then every choice you make, by the way, has different repercussions, and it would take too long to go into every one. But if you go into cash, you got to know where to store it so you can get a decent return and still have it liquid and still be protected and so on. So there's some issues that will be addressed. But so you want maybe some market assets, but you want some cash too. I think small business is the third place you want to put it in. And here I'm not talking about buying stock. I'm talking about you actually being invested in a mom and pop of some sort in your little community, because there's a value there. It's producing wealth. And then the fourth place is you want real assets, real tangible assets. And here traditionally we talk about gold and silver, but you can add in all kinds of things. I mean, guns and ammo, and you mentioned earlier food reserves and water and maybe some fuel, maybe some fishing poles and a boat and all kinds of different things we can throw in this category. But the value is in the thing. I call them intrinsic worth items. But you want some of your money in those things. And when you get that kind of true diversification, what happens is you just sleep better at night because you know, hey, if any one of these things bust a hole and starts leaking out, I got three or four other ones behind it supporting me.
Right. Yeah, I like the idea about the fishing poles.
Whenever I have guys in my office, I start talking to them about intrinsic worth items, and their eyes light up because they finally can tell their wives, you see, I told you I need that new shotgun.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is firearm sales are just going through the roof. You know, I was talking to a guy today. He was lamenting over the price of ammunition and everything. And I just kind of had to chuckle. And I said, well, you know, if you want a price reduction, I said, you know who to vote for in November. Let's talk a little bit about the unspoken or unknown issues that people face.
Well, that's a good one. And the reason being is that because they're unspoken of you, they're just not heard in the financial services arena. The real problem with financial planning that I found in doing this for the number of years I've done it is that there's people walking with a whole lot of presuppositions that you almost have to go digging through their contents to try to find. I'll give you a few examples. If you have an older client, I'm 48, so I kind of fall in the middle there. But if I have an older client, 10, 20 years older than me, they're very much impacted by their depression era parents. And so they come in with a very simple thought, and that is never going to debt, got to save. And mostly in cash, because that's what their parents told them, or maybe they experienced themselves. And so that's something that you have to kind of fight through. And then on the other side, if you have a lot younger clients, you know, they remember, from 82 to 2000, the market was the best thing since sliced bread. And even though they got walloped in 2000, 2008, they still expect that to turn around and do another 18 or 20-year run where the market just never goes low. And that's, I need to disabuse them of that idea.
Right.
So some of the unknown things are what the clients bring to me. But what the financial services industry never really speaks about, that I think we're doing a poor job both of advising clients in this area because it's leaving them with a giant blind spot, is the whole idea of monetary policy and inflation and what it's doing to your savings and your investments. You mentioned the current commander-in-chief, and I mean, he's doing his level best to just completely bankrupt us. I'm not saying he didn't have any help from the prior Republicans and Democrats before him. He certainly did. But it's just no holds barred now. We're gonna bail everything out. We're gonna spend money on every cause we can find, and we don't have any money, but we're gonna pretend like we do. We're just gonna use the credit card. That has implications on the individual, and if the person is not aware of that, to me, that is the largest area that the person walks in with a huge blind spot because they really don't know what to do about it.
Hey, Judy, do we have any callers?
We had one that dropped off the line, and I'm hoping they'll call back on. But we do have a question.
Okay.
Unless you guys want to finish your point, and then I'll shoot it out.
No, I think we're at a stopping point. What's the question?
The question is I think you were mentioning about credit, and the person is saying how safe is credit in terms of credit cards, and they get offers in the mail all the time about 0% interest for the first year, and is that a reliable source of parking some of your money? In other words, can you use credit like that, or is that dangerous? I guess is their question.
Right. I'm a proponent of a concept of a strategy called becoming your own banker. And you want a book on it, maybe you'll add it to your book list, Dave. It's Nelson Nash's. It's titled Becoming Your Own Banker, a guy named Nelson Nash, N-A-S-H. And if you want a similar book that has equally, probably more compelling financial points, you can pick up a book called LEAP, L-E-A-P. That stands for Lifetime Economic Acceleration Program. It's by Bob Castiglione. I'm not going to try to spell Bob's last name, or on your own on that one. But anyway, both of those guys talk about a very similar concept. And it's one that I've added to my financial planning practice, which is becoming your own banker. The reason I bring all this up is because it kind of applies peripherally to the question, Judy, and that is you really do not want to use external credit sources but for maybe your home. That's about the only one we really can handle. As a general rule, I recommend to all my clients that if they're going to finance things, they finance it themselves. They use one concept that the grandmothers would all be familiar with, which is kind of like a sinking fund. You just build up some capital, and whenever you need to, and grandmothers used to do it in CDs, and whenever they need to do something, they'd go cash the CD out, go buy the thing, and then start replenishing the money to their CD. Well, we use a very similar concept, but we do it in a way that's, I think, much more beneficial and a better storage vehicle for your cash. So, no, you don't want to use your credit cards. You want to credit yourself. You want to indebt yourself and then pay the interest and notes back to yourself. Now, if the question was intimating, and they may have been, I don't know, they may have said, well, you know, if all this is going to go down the tubes, talking about America and our financial system, why don't I go and indebt myself and let my debt go down the tubes with the country? Well, you can play that game if you want, but does anybody know when the country is going to expire exactly? I don't. And so, no, I don't play that game.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about what it means to bank on yourself? I've heard that concept quite a lot, and I have no idea what that really means, and it sounds like you're quite knowledgeable on that. Would you mind spending a moment discussing a little bit about that process, whatever it is?
Well, sure. You know, this is one of the, going back to kind of the early question, Dave, on the unknown issues we all fight. There are four, I call the four I's that we have as enemies of our financial plan. And the four I's are the inflation, interest, which is what we pay when we buy things on credit, the IRS, which is our tax friend, and I, meaning ourselves, me, I, whoever you want to say that. And so one of the four things is interest. And interest is something that we've kind of come to accept as a cost of doing business. Like, okay, well, everyone, when they get out of college, goes and buys a car on credit, and then they just are indebted for the car. Big deal. What's so bad about that? Well, what's so bad about it is that you will probably, if you do it that way, will probably, unless you talk to somebody like me, never get out of paying interest on a car. Now, of course, when they get married, they pay interest on two cars. And when they have a kid and he turns 15 or 16 or 17, whatever the age is, for their state, they'll be paying interest on three cars. And you can see the drain on a personal economy that interest starts to play. Add in their credit card or student loan debt or the vacation they take every year on credit or you name it, and all of a sudden interest becomes a big player in their economy, but in a negative fashion. All we're trying to do, Judy, in becoming your own banker is we're saying, let's stop this process. Let's change it around. If you're willing to pay interest to someone outside of yourself, why wouldn't you be willing to pay interest to someone inside, like your own bank? And so what you have to do is you've got to, one, find some capital, which means I got to go maybe refi a home. I might cash in a CD. I might take some money out of their retirement funds. But we're going to build capital, usually in a life insurance product. And there's a reason for that. Most people say, oh, you're trying to sell life insurance. Well, you might believe that, but I will say this about the life insurance product. It's the best place to store money. If you want to challenge me on that, call me, and you can challenge me, and I'll tell you why. I've written a blog about it. You can go there, too, and find out why I think it's the best place to store money. But we put in a life insurance contract because it's liquid, it's available, it earns good interest or dividends, it's asset protected, it's tax deferred. There's a whole bunch of reasons why it's the best place to store money. And then what you do is the next time that you have a big purchase like that, whether it be the vacation for $3,000 or the car for $15,000 or whatever, you say, you call David Simpson, you say, I want to borrow $15,000 from my life insurance contract. I send you the $15,000, you go buy the vehicle, and then you start the note back to yourself, back to the life insurance policy to refund it plus interest. And what happens is you have an ever-growing source of revenue, a source of cash, because it's earning dividends while it sits there, and you're replenishing it at interest to yourself. And that, in a nutshell, is being your own bank. It's really not complicated. It just seems that way, I guess.
David, is there a cap on it? I mean, can you only put $100 in it, does the IRS have an upper limit that you can get involved in this thing?
Yes and no. I mean, for the most part, I very rarely bump into any caps that I can't figure out. But in the insurance field, basically, and I'm sure you know this, Dave, but every life is only insurable for a certain amount of money. So let's say, as an example, you got a 5-year-old kid. They're not going to let you insure the kid for $5 million. They're going to say, no, there's no interest there worth insuring. They're going to assume that something's wrong with the kid and you're just trying to make $5 million on a sick kid or something, right?
Right.
That's kind of a sick way that the insurance companies look at things. But for the average adult, there's usually no cap that I can't really work around. So, no, you can dump a pretty good chunk of change in these things and build a good capital reserve rather quickly. And then you use that. Now, if you needed a larger bank, well, then the issue just becomes insure more people. Do one on your wife, maybe do one on your children, a business partner, anybody that you can legitimately say you have an insurable interest in, you can write a policy on. Now, one last thing. I tell this to people all the time. I'm not trying to hawk insurance policies. I've become convinced it's the best place to store money, both from my own research, my own running the numbers against other products, and also from Nelson Nash being kind of a mentor to me. But if you tell me that I'm full of baloney and you don't believe it, I don't care if you use an insurance policy, but I do care that you stop the interest drain, so start banking yourself in some other product. I don't care what it is. You can make it a bond fund. You can put it in a brokerage account. You can put it in a CD. I am so a big advocate. Stop paying interest outside and turn it to pay inside, and you will grow wealthy.
Right.
Well, gentlemen, it looks like we have a caller with a question, and I'm unable to screen him. So, are you willing to take a live shot at a question?
Oh, yeah.
An untrained, unrehearsed question. Here we go.
Okay.
Welcome. Welcome to the Dave Campbell Show, and you're on live. What's your question?
Hi, this. I actually No, David, I was actually going to ask him a little bit about if he might talk a little bit about the inflation side of things and kind of what he thinks in regards to where, how the perhaps the dollar may end up being devalued and how he may think that we, if we're headed in that direction, the things to think about in terms of storing money and investing in those kind of things.
Yeah, real good concern, good question, and good luck. No, I don't mean to be flippant about it. But truly, good luck for all of us. But the first answer, the first question: are we in for inflation? The answer is yes, yes, and more yes. One guy described it as a missile that's already been launched, just waiting to hit us. And that is probably as accurate a description as I could make of what's going to happen inflation-wise. The government's still maintaining we're running at, 3 or 4% or something. Maybe they bumped it up to 4.5%. I don't recall. I don't listen to their numbers anymore because they're – well, you said earlier, Dave, you know when someone's lying to you. Inflation, best estimates are going to jump up to 10 or 12% pretty soon. And one guy I've seen who is a pretty sound thinker – is saying that the United States might run to 100% inflation before the decade's out. Predicting when is tough. He say that the guy that I'm thinking of is saying, you know, in the next 3 to 4 years. But we only have, 8 years left, or it's seven and a quarter years left this decade, so it's going to be soon.
Right.
So inflation is probably going to be coming hard. What that really means to the average investor is just assume that the value of your dollar is going to be cut in half, and then in half again, and then in half again, meaning you can't buy anything with your dollars because they're worthless. What do you do? I think was the second follow-on question, and there's a couple of things you can do. One thing you can do is actually get long-term debt. I know that sounds strange, but for instance, you might want to indent your home. Why? Because you get the cash out now, and you can use it for something. I'll tell you what to use it for in a minute. But you see, the value of doing that is you're going to, if you get a 30-year mortgage on your home, let's say, and you're paying $1,000 a month. Well, guess what? Next month, you're giving them the same $1,000, but it's worth less. And next year, you're giving the same $1,000, and it's worth less. So you're basically repaying with cheaper dollars, and that actually makes sense in some kind of strange, demonic way. So that actually is not a bad idea. If you've got some equity in your home, you might want to pull it out. Why? Because you can pay back with cheaper dollars over the long term. The second thing is what to do with the money if you pull it out. And the answer to that is kind of twofold. It depends on how quickly you think inflation is coming and how bad. If you think it's going to be kind of mild for a while, you might try to invest it and earn some yield in the market, okay, to take extra more cash, in other words, gather more. If you think it's coming quicker and more furious, then I think the only answer is to go hard assets. So you're buying the gold and the silver, the guns and the ammo, and maybe a second home that you have paid off that you can move to if you have to leave the indebted home. It's your choice, but you would start moving to the hard assets. That's really your only protection.
I think that answers everything I was asking.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling in.
Thanks.
Put you back on hold so you can listen to the show. Thank you.
Looks like we have another one in the queue, Judy.
Yeah. Should we throw them up and see what they want to say?
Absolutely.
Sure. All right, here we go. Wide and unscripted. Dave Campbell, so you're on the air with David.
Welcome.
David and Judy, do you have a question for our guest or our host? It's a shy person. They're not saying anything.
Yeah, it must be.
All right. We won't
All
push
right.
you. Okay. Back to the thing on inflation, though. I think that's a fascinating question. You mentioned the fact that you were going to say where to park your money later. So if you took out some, and you were saying hard assets, other than a house, what would you choose as a hard asset?
Well, excuse me, Judy, there's a list. I mean, obviously gold and silver and coinage or bullion would be a very good place. Here's the sticking point with that thing. And a lot of guys, I'm not a gold bug or a silver bug. I do buy silver for my clients on occasion. We pool the money and get a good price buying directly from a mint. But here's the problem with gold and silver, and it's real simple. I mean, if we have an economic calamity, I'm talking about, you know, 1929 again, but maybe worse, because it's going to be worse than 1929, because in 1929,
right. Yeah.
we still had a whole bunch of farmers and people producing. I mean,
right.
What do we have today? You know, we got Monsanto farms, but nobody out there really doing anything themselves.
Nope.
And so more than likely to be worse than 1929. So here's my question. If you're sitting there and there's literally no food on the shelves at Walmart, and there's nowhere to go buy, you know, just the average daily things, what good is gold and silver do you? You know, you can't eat it. You might be hard-pressed to even trade it. And so I think immediately after an economic catastrophe, if we have another 1929 type of event, gold and silver is going to be nice to have for about maybe a year or a year and a half later when things return to some kind of normalcy. But immediately you're going to want to have some things like real food. So I recommend in my financial planning practice food storage. I recommend having seeds and the non-hybrid seeds, of course. So you store these things. Water, fuel. Like I said, fishing poles. Why? Because you can go catch a fish and eat him. It's those kind of things. And I know this sounds almost hokey. People sometimes lean across my desk and they kind of start to whisper and they go, what do you think is going to happen? You know? And I go, I don't know. What do you think is going to happen? You know, it's one of those things. Well, I don't know, but anything could happen. Right.
Yeah.
And so I my son just joined the Boy Scouts and you know that their motto is be prepared. I think it's a great motto. Be prepared.
You know, one of the things I'm hearing that you say is, and it really struck me, is that we don't have producers anymore.
We become
all of us run down to the Walmart to get a tomato. We don't grow them anymore. So it's a very shaky society that we've created, a very dependent society. I think, Dave, you started out talking about self-reliance. Maybe the two of you could talk a little bit about the importance of self-reliance in these trying times.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I had started out the whole discussion on self-reliance kind of shying away from this topic and just dealing with the internal self-reliance, you know, the internal will, the consciousness, and all that stuff. But several years ago, and I don't know if you read it or not, David, Pugsley wrote a book called Guns and Butter. This was back, quite frankly, during the Carter years when inflation was running 15%+ and so on and so forth. And he actually, part of his plan was, you know, firearms, munitions, food, water, all the different things that you could use to barter. And on the last of his list was obviously the hard metals. But he was an advocate of what you had just said is, mm-hmm. you know, you're not really going to be able to put a cougar in between two slices of bread and eat it. It was a situation where, you know, you needed to understand how to can your food, you know, how to grind wheat, how to bake bread, how to do a garden.
Right.
And, you know, there was a big upsurge and quite frankly, I think this is where the start of Mother Earth News magazine started.
Right.
Was,
right.
You know, talking about all of those different kinds of components. And then, you know, obviously we got addicted to some prosperity and a lot of that kind of went by the wayside. But I do think, because I actually take the subscription to Mother Earth News, I do think there's a resurgence on urban autonomy, you know, where people are planning, their gardens. People are trying to, or in some cases successfully, taking their houses off the grid. And there seems to be more and more of it.
There is.
Because I think people just are starting to, in their own instincts are starting to sense that the ball is cracked. And, it's going to take an awful lot of glue to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Yeah. Dave, that is absolutely correct. And you know, I'll add to that, didn't mean to interrupt you, I'll add to that I'm speaking a little bit apocalyptic here, and that frightens people sometimes. And then they say, well, you know, at the end they go, why are you laughing? You know, you're joking and you're laughing, and it seems like you're kind of happy, and you just gave me the worst news of my life. And the answer is, well, I don't say these things to scare you into despair. I say these things to motivate you into hope, right? We're trying to move from where we are now into something that we want to be. And if we right now are not productive, as Judy was saying, and if we right now are not self-reliant, and I'm talking about that intro one that you're talking about, in the way that you just mentioned, if we're not hopeful, and I will add, I think it's absolutely essential, if we're not faithful, if we don't believe in something higher than ourselves, then we're going to fail. And so the reason I can laugh at the end of it all is because it's not apocalyptic in my mind. It's going to be hard. It's dangerous. It's going to be sacrifice and difficult work. But my goodness, humankind, I believe, is up to the task. All we have to is do it.
Yeah. No, I agree, and quite frankly, it may be just the kick in the butt that everybody needs. It's interesting. I mean, you know, it's either politics that have been the course of discussion. Obviously, the tragedy in Benghazi with the ambassador, or the NFL replacement reps. It's been extraordinary, and the Middle East is burning down, and all I've heard on the news is a couple of goofy presidential polls, and the fact that the replacement refs may be back for game four. The world's burning around our ears here. And Nero's fiddling, and we're worried about a football game.
Crazy.
And I think that kind of sets the tone of what you and I and a lot of other people, quite frankly, are trying to, you know, shake people by the lapels and go, you know, God gave you that wonderful organ between your ears. Start using it.
Yeah,
you know,
please, by all means, start using it, and rapidly, you know.
Yeah, I mean, exercise the damn thing, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah,
you just don't sit there and let somebody just continue to pour crap into it. You have the ability to use it, you know.
Speaking of, let me add one more thing to my list of things that you can invest in. Judy, this is directed to you because you mentioned buying a tomato. There are, and Dave, you brought the idea to my head by saying that people are becoming to look like they're turning into getting some self-reliance again and starting to do some little co-oping and that kind of stuff. There are these little things. You can find local farmers just about anywhere who are trying to get people to basically invest in their farms, and then they guarantee you back a certain production of the yield of the crops. Of course, you know, you can lose some because the crops may not come in, but I have people locally doing this. I wish I could remember the website. Dave, if I can find it, I will email it to you, and you can
look up. Yeah.
But you can basically send, let's just say you give the guy $1,000, and then literally every part of the season, every time the crops come in, they come deliver you whatever the crop yield was that, you know, there might be a certain number of carrots, a certain amount of tomatoes, a certain amount of lettuce, the radishes, and you name it, and he just comes and throws it on your doorstep. And what I like about the model is just what you're talking about. We're not beaten. We are, if we're individuals who are going to try to hunker down and save ourselves by buying guns and groceries. That's a failed plan. It always has been. What I try to emphasize to people is we are trying to build a community here. that loves one another, that respects one another, that helps one another, and in doing so, we're all going to be better off, even if the world turns to absolute sour nastiness. But if we think we can run to the hills and that's going to save us, you can forget that notion. No man is completely self-sufficient. That's why we have division of labor. That's why this economy is so fantastic, because we did divide labor up and said, hey, you supply me with the dental work, and I'll supply you with the doctor work, and I'll supply you with the lawyer work, and so on and so forth. And that's a great model. Now we just have to turn it back a couple of dials, because the fact of the matter is we need to get back to some of the basics of production and divide that up amongst people, and then say, okay, if it really turns bad and I can no longer do dentistry, what am I going to do? And you need to have a second answer to that question. You need to have a backup earnings mechanism. I actually advocate that in my plan too. So you actually start planning to develop maybe a hobby into a second income, or you start taking a hard skill that you know will be necessary in bad times. I actually am considering taking a gunsmithing course. It would be useful. And it's probably about all I can do, because I'm not that good at farming and ranching. But just do anything, but think about your fellow man. How would I help my fellow man in the worst of situations? And I promise you, that will lead you to some very fruitful endeavors.
You know, I was just sitting here thinking about canning. I mean, I grew up. My mom canned and everything else, and Just something that simple, you know, getting together and passing down the whole canning ritual to help urban housewives start to understand that they can go out to, you know, and we still have weekend markets here. You go out and buy a bushel of peaches, for God's sake, come home and can the damn things.
Yeah.
Put them on the shelf, and you can do it one weekend a month or whatever, and lo and behold, before it's over with, you've got a pantry full of canned fruits and vegetables and stuff, you know?
Right. You know a guy you can go look up, the one name I can't remember, that would bring you to some good agricultural type of things that all these issues relate to, is a guy named Joel Salatin. It's Salatin. He runs a place called Polyface Farms in Virginia. And he's just a brilliant – you ever meet one of these guys, he's salt of the earth, he's a farmer, and by God, he's just got the wisdom of nature, you know, built into him. And
right.
he's always just so wonderful to listen to. But he could direct you to some of these co-op-type farms I was mentioning earlier. But he says the same thing. He uses this word all the time, and I'm going to forget it now, of course. We would call it a pantry, but he calls it a larder,
right.
I think he's always –
Larder, root cellar, right.
And he's always using that word, and it was kind of funny. I'm reading his book, and I kept seeing larder, and I finally remember, that's what kind of used to call like where we store all the food, right?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, he says during the when they can't grow, let's say tomatoes, he goes down and do his larder and pulls out canned tomatoes, you know? Right there, sure.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, and you can say what you want one way or the other, but there's an entire state, an entire religion that puts a lot of effort into what we're just talking about.
Yes, they do.
And the self-preparedness, and it's something that needs to be. You know, given some life, we need to put some water on it. We need to start growing that kind of thought process. You know, maybe it needs to be done in conjunction with helping people clear the clutter out of their head and get to a little bit more simplistic view of the world, a little bit more naturalistic view of the world, as opposed to all of this technological mumbo jumbo that everybody seems to be enthralled with. And, you know, the first time somebody poops an EMT or something like that and their Game Boy goes down, they're going to be absolutely apoplectic. You know, they're not going to be able to do it again.
Yes. Well, you know, we get regular trial runs with this. You see, down here in Louisiana, every time we have a hurricane, I get to practice,
yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
And by the By the way, that's another thing, indication, going way back to earlier in our conversation, how do you know when somebody is giving you kind of good scoop and bad versus bad scoop? I always tell people when they're talking to their financial advisors or lawyers, it doesn't matter, their CPAs, ask them if they eat their own cooking, meaning do they use the same advice that they're giving you, right? And so I'm not going to tell you that I'm a complete guns and grocery guy, but I have my own chickens, okay? And I have fruit trees out of my back porch, and I have food stored in my garage. I better not say that. People might come rip me off. But in other words, I believe it enough to do it. Now, if I end up being wrong, everybody laughs at me one Sunday, okay, Dave's a big idiot. I guess I don't care. I don't care if they all laugh at me, you know, when it's all said and done. I'm preparing because I believe it, and I'm going to at least do what I can to protect my family and those and my community.
Well, you know, and interestingly enough, David, that's all part of the thing is if you're your own person, what somebody else thinks or doesn't think has absolute no bearing on it. Because if you're true to what you are, you know, that's the whole essence of individualism is you don't get sucked into somebody else's definition. You make your own definition. And somebody
right.
else makes their own definition. And, you know, and nobody, there isn't a conflict there. You know, it's just astounding to me because I agree with you. I think a lot of the things that is hampering people from doing this is the simple fact that they're not going to be accepted over this whole thing.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Dave. You're absolutely right. I have people in my office constantly. They will sit there, and you know, after we talk, and by the way, like I said, I don't really sell. What I do is I feel like I'm doing like counseling. You know, I feel like I'm kind of marriage counselor, part legal counselor, part financial counselor. But anyway, I will spend an hour and a half, 2 hours, sometimes in multiple versions. Sometimes this goes 3 and 6 hours. Just talking to someone, and before it's over, their heads are bobbing, yes, 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 yes. And then a year later, they'll come back and see me, and, you know, because, you know, they were supposedly working on the plan for a year, right, maybe doing some little follow-ups every quarter or so, but for the most part, I don't really look for another official meeting for a year, and they'll come back, and they haven't done anything. And I bashed my head against the wall for years wondering why. Why is that? Why is that? Why is that? And I came to finally the same exact conclusion you just said. They just know that when they take that step, they're going to be different from Sally Q next door, and that bothers them.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely. You know,
David, if I have a question for you, if I can be so bold.
Sure.
Number one. Does the work that you do, can you do that across state lines, or are there restrictions? That somebody wants to know. And if it doesn't, isn't restricted to your neck of the woods, how do people get a hold of you?
Okay, it's not. I work currently in about, I think it's 10 or 12 states now. And what I do when someone calls me from another state, the first thing I do is go find out how much it's going to cost me to get licensed there and whether or not it's going to be a bureaucratic nightmare. Not to be mean, but, you know, if you live in Illinois, I'm not going to work with you because they charge me an arm and a leg to become licensed there, and they think they own me, you know. And so I don't work in Illinois, but I work in lots of other states that aren't near as bad, and most of them I think are pretty good. And so, yes, I do work across state lines. I just have to get licensed there. That's always an issue, but I'll tell the person up front, I'll find out first if I can work with them. And then to contact me, you can go to my website, and by the way, it's not up and running, it just has a few pages on it, but it's, you know, www.tffco, that's Tom Frank Frank Charles Oscar.com, okay? That stands for The Physical Fitness Company. Or you can just call me, and the office line, let me see if I remember my doggone, I can never remember my own doggone 800 number, that's pretty bad.
I've got it, David. It's 985-260-0066, Judy.
Yeah, that's my that's my main office line. I was thinking of a toll free, Dave. If they wanted to call me toll free, so let me pull that number up. I never dialed, so I'm not gonna remember.
Yeah, I've got
the
it,
number.
David. 888 Yes. 865-1866, Judy. That's toll free.
No, I'm sorry, Dave. It's 888-816-1865.
Oh, okay. I was just reading it off your email, David.
I might have gotten crossed up.
Okay, say it one more time. 888.
Let me.
816-1865.
And if that's on my email.
865. Okay.
Yeah, it is on my email like that, Dave. And I bet you, I don't know what the world is going on. Well, anyway, I'm not going to worry about it. I've been having a little corruption to some of my files, and I wonder if it did that to my thing. But it is 888-816-1865. And I'm going to go correct that on my email right now because that is going out like that, and I'm sorry to see that.
Great. That's great news to a lot of the people who've been listening tonight because they'd like to follow up. And you mentioned that, do you also have a book or materials people want to know? And you've mentioned the website, but are there books and materials that people can read that you have written?
Yeah, from my website, one of the only active pages is my blog, and you can go to my blog, and I have several writings on there from several years, but I also have a bibliography, so that'd be the first place I'd go to find some books, and most of the books I think they would need to kind of get into my, you know, my train of thinking are listed there. I also like people to read, you know, I know blogs can be kind of tedious. I try to keep mine short and to the point if I can. But when people read the blog, I think they really get a good sense of kind of what I've gone through. You know, whenever you start a business or you start into a field, I started in law, and I practiced law for about 5 years and just couldn't stomach it anymore. You know, you learn more about the business once you start doing it. And so when I started finance, I was just trained like everyone else is trained. I went to Prudential, and boom, they trained me to be a Prudential guy. But when I started practicing, I realized that, man, you know, what they told me were all the answers just weren't working out for my clients that well. And so you kind of get that in my blog. You kind of see the growth of the guy who says, wait a second, what they told me in school ain't exactly the real world.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens.
Yeah. And so it was in my quest to find real answers for real clients, for real problems, that I came across the Be Your Own Banker system, and then I added a few pieces around it to make it what I think is better, and I haven't found anything better yet, but if I do, I will add that. I'm not married to an idea because I'm trying to, like I said, sell you on an idea. I'm married to it because I've seen it work, and if I find something better, I'll add that to it.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are very thankful that you're explaining that bank on yourself because they've been inundated with ads and they're not really sure what that meant. Thank you so much for that clarity for me and for everyone else that's been listening. That really, really meant a lot. So appreciate it a great deal.
Judy, I noticed, I probably came across this I don't know. I'm going to say 8 years ago, but it may be a little bit shorter. But and when I learned about it, and I was on teleconferences with the guy who wrote the book, Nelson Nash, and I called him up personally a few times to ask him a few questions and to challenge him on a few things. But when I first did this, probably 8 years ago, there was virtually no other person talking about it besides Nelson Nash. And I've noticed, and I don't go look very often, but the last time I went to go look for a link to his book on Amazon to send it to a person who was interested in it, I noticed, you know, on Amazon they have the books that are related you might be interested in also.
Right.
When you look for one book, they show you about 10 other ones you might want to buy. There were all these books and all these names of people I'd never heard of in this field, and they were all, of course, claiming that they were better than Nelson or the founder or whatever else, and I knew that was all a lie because I'd been around long enough to know who the movers were in this field. And so, yes, there's a lot of new people on the block, and I found one other thing I'm a little concerned about. I had a guy call me because what he did was he called me after I was on another radio show, and he said, you know, can you work in my state? And I said, yeah. He goes, I'll tell you what, I'd rather work with somebody I can actually, you know, go see around the block. So I'm going to call one of the local guys. So he actually went on Nelson Nash's website, found a local Be Your Own Banker guy, and called him. Well, he called me a week or so later, and he said, and it was unbelievable. He says, listen, he goes, I really enjoyed talking to you because you answered all my questions, but I called this other guy, and he told me to bring, I don't know what it was, $20,000, $30,000 to his office. And then, and then he goes, I know what I'm doing. I'll take care of you. Bring me your money, and don't worry about it. That was his sales pitch, right? And I was just, I was completely flabbergasted and offended. And I said, well, I'm sorry that's what happened to you because I really was surprised. But I guess what I'm saying, the short of it is that there are a lot of people jumping on this bandwagon, and it is a good thing. I hope they don't sour people on it because it really is the right thing to do for most people in their finances. And unless you find a real idiot like this guy trying to sell this other fellow without even talking to him, you should find a good guy who's willing to explain it and make you feel comfortable in doing it and then show you how to do it. There's just no excuse for anything less than that.
Hey, David, I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
You know, number one, if half the country did this, I think it would be the impact to the financial system in this country would be astounding. That's number one. But I'm just wondering that if this impact keeps growing, say 10% of the population finally wakes up, the light bulb finally pops on, and they start doing this, what do you think the federal government's going to do against the insurance companies to try to sequester this or do something to stop this?
You know, I almost wish you wouldn't ask me that, Dave.
I hate to be the protagonist, but I'm just sitting here wondering because
you're right. Listen,
like
when
no good deed goes unpunished, you know.
Yeah, when I first started doing this, not that I tried to keep it quiet or anything, but you know, reason I don't even have a good working website is because I really don't want to wave a big flag and say, "Hey guys, you know, we're really getting around the banking institutions. Look at us, you know." That's not exactly what I wanted to do, and that's what kind of bothered all these people jumping on board and being so overt and being so stupid about it, you know.
Right.
There is truth to be said that, you know, everyone supposedly, you know, is big into right to privacy. Well, basically nothing's private anymore. In my opinion, lots of things should be private.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that I should be able to do and say and feel and think and whatever else. They're nobody else's business but my own, you know. Well, anyway, your question is to the point, which is, what if we actually make an impact on the banks and the IRS and government revenues and everything else? And the answer is obvious. And you know it, and I know it. They would
move to
shut it down,
and move
overtly to make new rules. Now, whether we got grandfathered in or not, I don't know. Whether or not there'd be some kind of escape clause for the people who are using this process, probably, if there's still any justice at all. But you're absolutely right. It's a real, real, real danger. I can give you a perfect analogy. In the 70s, when you're talking about Carter years, when inflation had gotten to 16-17% or whatever it got to, that's when universal life was created. And universal life was based on interest rates. And so they started waving this big advertisement everywhere saying, the last great tax dodge. And guess what the government did? They went in there and limited how much money you could put into a life insurance contract because they said, no, you can't sell this as a tax dodge. You got to be selling insurance.
Well, that's why I asked you the question about how much you could invest in the bank on yourself stuff is because, you know, I went through, I didn't participate, but I knew about that entire issue, you know, back during the Carter years when the universal life stuff hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It was a real deal and they slammed them. I mean, yes. And you're right. Matter of fact, when I was saying there's not any cap that I can't kind of work around usually, the caps that I'm having to work around are IRS rules that are still from the 1970s, from the UL issue, the universal life issue, and they're applying it to whole life, which really is ridiculous. It shouldn't apply to whole life, but they do because they apply it across the board. And so everyone got kind of creamed because some guys couldn't keep their mouths shut and just say and stop trying to like fly the missile right into the Washington space, you know. So whatever.
Yeah, no, exactly. And It probably is going to depend on how many politicians in Congress are participating in this, on whether they're actually doing something. You know, it's kind of like the whole countrywide mortgage thing, right? You know, as long as everybody was getting the sweet mortgage deals, everything was all, you know, nice and nice and nice. And then somebody finally blew the whistle on those poor guys. So I just, you know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I do think it's probably a marvelous way to do it. I love the idea of getting out from underneath and basically financing your own activities. The relative freedom that just that whole mental picture brings, it's just great.
Yeah. And you know what else, Dave? You know what else? It can become a family type of planning thing where you teach your kids and the kids use the same capital that you created, and then all of a sudden you can expand into buying businesses or whatever else. It has a matter of fact, one of the names for it is infinite banking process. They say infinite because it's an infinite use of your capital. What can you dream up to use your capital for? That's what you can do when you do this, and it's true.
Is there a minimum, David, to get started with this? Or, I mean, can you do like a monthly addition to this thing, like you would for financing, you know, a 401k or something like that? Can you set that up?
There really is no minimum. The impact that comes from maybe funding it on a lower end level, let's just say $200 a month or $500 a month or something like that, is that you don't build up capital as fast. It might take you 5-7 years to get enough capital to really start using it effectively as a bank. So most times people like the idea of going to try to find some capital in their current wealth and really super fund the bank early. But no, there's no minimum. And in matter of fact, usually on children, you can't do it any other way. Like if I'm going to do it on my kids, they're, you know, a 10-year-old kid, I've got to go in at $100 a month or $200 a month or something. Because his particular insurability won't operate any other way. In other words, I can't write a policy any bigger than that on him. Now, what you're trying to do with these policies is you're trying to de-emphasize the life insurance component. Like I'm not really trying to buy death benefit. I'm trying to accentuate capital buildup. I want more cash value quicker and faster. And so a lot of times people say, well, I only have $2,000 or I only have $5,000 or what they come up with a number. I don't care what your number is. If you only have $100 a month, I can build you a bank, and the whole goal is to not buy you life insurance per se, even though that comes as part of the program. It's to buy you a bucket that I put cash in, if that makes any sense. And I just dump that cash in there, whatever amount it is, and try to build up as fast as I can.
Right.